de lunes a jueves.
The Safari Park. You're killing me, Larry.
Hello, Larry.
Larry, get into bed now.
Come on, Larry!
Is there no sweeter sound than that of your own name buried in cheers and applause? I think not. Hey, are you in a cult? Ask that question of anyone you know, and you'll probably get an emphatic no. They'll likely be somewhat offended. Cult members don't get a lot of admiration. They're mostly regarded as weak-minded sheep, directionless people with low self-esteem and a powerful need to be led. California may be the cult capital of the nation, maybe the world. I have some theories about that. Especially Southern California, where for the last century, anyone in any other part of the world who thought they were kind of cute has swarmed here in hope of becoming a movie star. Those types tend not to be very well grounded, and when they run out of options and money and hope, that's when they become ripe for a cult. Charlie Manson knew this. He was a creepy borderline dwarf with nothing going for him, yet he assembled a harem of dozens of women who did anything he wanted, including murder. None of those chicks was even remotely pointy save one, Ruth Ann Morehouse, who was kind of cute. And when her daddy found out she was living with Manson's tribe, he hauled ass out to their hideout to rescue his baby girl. And Charlie got wind of his approach, so instead of confronting an angry dad, he sent out his A-team of gingham-clad hippie whores. And pretty soon, Ruth's daddy wasn't so angry anymore, or intent on rescuing his kid. Does it get any weirder than that? Say the word cult, and what do you think? Kooks, weirdos, guys in saffron robes with genie hairdos and tambourines and a 10-yard stare, usually asking for money. And if you said to anyone, well, you're in a cult, they'd probably be insulted. But lots of us are, in one way or another, a member of a cult. It may not be as overt as saffron robes and communal living, but you needn't dig too deep to find the cult. What do I know about cults? Plenty. I grew up in the Roman Catholic Church, one of the biggest. They might deny it. Religion sounds so much more above board and less sinister than cult. But all religions are cults, make no mistake about it. If it's our religion, it's a religion, or to put a halo around it, a faith. If it's somebody else's religion, that's a cult. Francis Xavier, the co-founder of the Jesuits, reputedly said, "Give me a child until he is seven, and I will give you the man." Many of us don't even realize we're in a cult until we have some kind of epiphany well into adulthood. And many live their entire lives and never realize they are being manipulated. They all concoct their own self-serving definitions of cults, definitions that position themselves far away from cults, of course. But no matter the religion, if you believe in an all-powerful being or entity or energy, something or someone with the power to create life and planets and the universe, why the hell would they need a middleman? Some costumed guy. They almost always need costumes, don't they? Someone to say, hey, you don't know the secret word or handshake, but if you give me some Skrilla, I can get you in to see the big man through the service entrance. Now, I'm no atheist, but I tend not to like middlemen. So I go direct, and that works okay for me. Seems cults, they used to be more visible, but now they're where everyone spends their time, on social media. Every so often, some cult that's beneath the radar explodes into worldview in some spectacular fashion, like Jonestown or Hale Bopp or ISIS. When innocents are killed, it's an atrocity. When they're mature adults, allegedly of sound mind, as in the Heaven's Gate Hail Bop case. It's really high comedy. It happened in the mid-90s when a comet was about to swing through our galactic neighborhood. Some goober named Marshall Doe Applewhite decided it was the chance of a lifetime. So he convinced 39 people that if they all killed themselves at the right time, they could hitch a ride on the spaceship that was following the comet's tail and ascend into paradise. And they did it in such a weird fashion. Rented a big mansion near San Diego and prepped and prepped, and finally the big day arrived. They all went to bed wearing purple napkins and identical Nike sneakers because, you know, St. Peter, whoever the keeper of Heaven's Gate is very particular about footwear.
Sorry, pal, we don't let anybody in here wearing Crocs, loafers, or Adidas. Hey, you back there, you with the Nikes, come on, front of the line.
So once they were properly dressed, they drank poison and wrapped their heads in plastic bags, and zoom, it was off to that spaceship in the sky. It really was pretty funny. They had mostly worked in website development, as is often the case with these STEM prodigies, huh? Some of them aren't too clear with reading comprehension. So inscrutable bullshit is always a tip-off you're deep in cult country. And they love to redefine simple words. That's typical. Now, here's a sample right from the Heaven's Gate website, which, by the way, is still up. They say they are against suicide because, quote,
"The true meaning of suicide is to turn against the next level when it is being offered,"
unquote. Did you get that? It's all clear? Well, okay then. Most of the guys had castrated themselves. Not exactly sure why Applewhite insisted they do that. Maybe something to do with wind resistance when you're chasing a comet through outer space. There was a time when New York City was just crawling with cults. They were having turf wars, just like pimps and dealers and street vendors.
Hey, get the fuck off of this corner. Me and my God had it first.
For a while, it was the Hare Krishnas and the Moonies. There need not be any theological underpinnings for a belief system to be a cult. If you think about it, our culture is crazy for cults. It often tries to force us into one or the other. Being from New York, I still get people demanding to know whether I'm a Yankee or a Met fan. When I tell them neither, that I don't give a fuck about baseball, I get the look. What is that look? I guess it's the same look religious zealots give to atheists. It's a mix of surprise and revulsion. The subtext is,
what the fuck do you mean you don't like baseball? Are you a commie? Are you a queer? What the fuck is wrong with you?
We get the same cultish bullshit with politics. They demand you make a choice. Not the choice you want, but the choice that only their little pointy heads, with limited powers of reasoning and usually no imagination whatsoever, can understand. Are you a Republican or a Democrat? And when you tell them neither, again, they start to fritz out like that android blonde Daryl Hannah played in Blade Runner. You've fed them information they cannot process, and their circuits just blow. Maybe cults are just brands. And Madison Avenue got hip to that scam 100 years ago. For most of a century, people were commanded to make a choice. Are you a Marlboro man or a Winston man? All of this shit Reynolds and Philip Morris brands of slow death and ill health had images more carefully crafted and protected than that of dictators and movie stars. Marlboro men were range-riding cowboys with square jaws and weathered hands. Winston men were more urban with slacks and loafers, kind of like Don Draper. The Camel Filters guy was neither. He was a maverick and a lone wolf. So each could look forward to emphysema or cancer in either a Western or urban or bohemian fantasy world. They did it, and still do it, with great success with automobiles. You had to make a choice. Take a stand. Were you a Ford man or a Chevy man? Or one of those Chrysler weirdos? Now you're either a Cro-Magnon internal combustion villain or an enlightened and holy guardian of Gaia in your Tesla or Prius. Or if you really care about Mother Earth, you take mass transit and pedal your bike with a helmet, chin strap snugged, because you want to be safe. And as all the must-have gizmos of today with their planned obsolescence proliferate, so does our choices in choosing our cults. Prelates bemoan the downturn, and Americans with no faith in a higher power. That some only 85% or so of Americans say they're religious or spiritual today compared with 98% 50 years ago. Well, they don't understand. No one has abandoned religion. They've just switched. And the new church is consumerism. And the cathedral is Amazon. And Bezos, with his weird face and shaved head, he could be some kind of pope, no? Besides being raised in the cult that is the Roman Catholic Church, I've had a couple of fun brushes with even nuttier cults myself. I was in New York when cults were just raging everywhere, and I'm working at this glitzy magazine, and one day we're all called to the big conference room with the big long table, just like in Mad Men, so we can be formally introduced to the newest staff member, Carson Bates. Now, this struck us all as odd, because when we started working there, there was no fanfare whatsoever. It's, here's your office, here's what you're supposed to do, go do it. But for Carson, they rolled out the welcome wagon. It was much more of a limousine. The publisher himself made the introduction, almost as if he'd be working for Carson. And then people started nosing around. And as I always say, there are no mysteries or damn few. In short order, we learned that Carson is connected to the tippy top of the food chain. His uncle is the CEO. No wonder they're all kissing his ass up and down the hallways. And it seemed like suddenly everybody around the joint had two jobs, their own and kissing Carson's ass. One big stupid oaf, each time he'd pass Carson in the hall, he would shout, "Here he is, the awesome Carson Bates!" It wasn't remotely funny the first time, and after several days in, we were drawing straws as to who would hit him in the face with a bag of nickels. Not that Carson was a bad guy. He was not. He never gave anyone the impression that he was connected to the top. He was a pretty humble dude. No airs, no pretensions, no attitude whatsoever. We had a few short conversations, and I found Carson to be okay. The hosannas and accolades and cheers and high fives, they went on for months until quarterly reports came out. And numbers can be fudged, but I've yet to see anyone be able to round up a zero. Because that's what Carson had achieved. And no one said anything. They dared not. I actually felt bad for the guy. It was obvious to anyone who wasn't blinded by the cheeks of Carson's ass that he was shoehorned into the job by his uncle, and that he had no aptitude whatsoever for selling. And as with most people who are doing the wrong job, Carson not only failed to perform, he failed to thrive. That idiot stopped announcing Carson's approach in the hallway. His name no longer had awesome as a prefix. He was even seen eating lunch alone. A few upper management types went into overdrive, trying to devise some way in which Carson could shine. They threw mentors at him who would set up big accounts for him like a golf ball on a tee. All Carson had to do to close was basically ask for the order, and still he whiffed him. It was getting embarrassing for everyone, especially Carson. And then one day he did not show up for work, didn't call in sick. The next day, the same thing. By day three, they were calling his apartment. No answer. Somebody got in touch with his family. They hadn't seen him. They assumed he was happily doing his job at a world-famous and glamorous magazine. By the fifth day, "Where's Carson?" was the prevailing question throughout the entire company. There were blizzards of hypotheses. He'd been mugged and was lying in an alley. He'd been mugged and was in a hospital in a coma or with amnesia. He'd tapped into his trust fund and skipped for Belize. He'd run off with some chick. He was a closet alky and was on a 2-week bender in Atlantic City. A couple of wise guys even cooked up a pool, like for the Super Bowl. I threw in $20 myself. Nobody was getting any work done. The mysterious missing Carson was a constant distraction. To me,
The guy seemed lost from day one. And I thought when I met him that he looked like cult fodder. So seizing on my suite of vocal impersonations, I realized I could do a very, very good impersonation of Carson. He was from the South and sounded vaguely Elvis-esque. And caller ID was not yet widespread, so late one night, just for shits and giggles, I lobbed a call to the publisher's secretary.
Is not available. At the tone, please record your message.
Well, hello, Ann. This is Carson. Carson Bates. And I just want to say I'm okay. No one should worry. I met some really cool people, and they're taking good care of me. I don't think I'll be coming back to work there, because this here's what I'm really supposed to be doing. It's good work. It's holy work. It's God's work. Bye.
The next morning, I made sure to get to the office before Anne and loiter around her desk while she checked her voicemail. I watched her access it and fast-forward through message after message. I knew she hit pay dirt when her eyes got wide like saucers and she gasped. In a hot minute, there was a crowd of 50 or 60 around her desk and she replayed the message on speakerphone again and again. Everybody was an amateur cop trying to guess the location from the background noise or which cult had snagged him. Within the hour, there were real cops in the office listening to that message, as Carson's family had reported him as a missing person some days earlier. Meanwhile, I'm biting holes in the inside of my cheeks, trying to suppress laughter. I had told no one what I'd done. I had no confederates with whom to snicker over this colossal scam. I cannot tell you how much I wanted to leap up onto her desk, tell them all, that was me, not Carson, you fucking fools. Of course, I'd have been fired on the spot and probably do some jail time. But I didn't for a second regret my little caper. They all deserved to be conned and faked out. Because of their ass-kissing bullshit, Carson had been set up to fail. I suppose it began with his big wheel uncle, but all the rest of those corporate sycophants were complicit in his undoing. For several days, the Carson mystery was the only water cooler talk. And then, as always, something knocked him off the front page of their minds. Probably a terrorist act or an election or something. And once in a while, someone would say, "What the hell ever happened to Carson Bates?" He was our Amelia Earhart, which, by the way, is no mystery at all. She didn't just disappear into the goddamn Twilight Zone. They knew she was going down. They could just never recover the wreckage or the body. And even now, with all the electronic crap and GPS and locating beacons, they still haven't found Malaysia Flight 370, a Boeing 777, and 239 people. That's a lot bigger than Amelia and her little Lockheed. But it's a big goddamn ocean, isn't it? And one day, the publisher's secretary gets a hand-addressed envelope with no return address, opens it up, and boom, there's a snapshot of Carson in a saffron robe with a genie haircut and a tambourine looking blissed out. And she screams and runs down the hall, "He's alive! He's alive!" She jumped right on the phone and called his family. But they'd known about it for months. My crazy prank phone call was spot on. He was cult fodder. They had grabbed him in Grand Central Station one night, tore off his necktie and wingtip brogies, and he never looked back. Who the hell knows where he is now? That was a long time ago. But the Krishnas are still in business, and I've sat on this secret for many, many years. My other cult brush was in Los Angeles. The office I worked at was lined with babage, and two of them took a liking to your humble host. The stunningly pointy Tanya, and the not as pointy but still quite delectable Sister Stevens. Her real name was Samantha, but since she was always proselytizing for her cult, I nicknamed her Sister, and it stuck. Oh, the prurient thoughts I entertained about Tanya and Sister Stevens! I could see them catfighting in cat suits. One swinging a huge crucifix like a broadsword, the other a flaming censer on a chain like a mace. They'd swing and miss, their thighs would flex and their teeth would flash, and they'd hiss, "He's mine, bitch, give up!" After a long and sweaty battle, both near exhaustion and no imminent victor, an angel would appear on his chariot and command them to make peace and share me equally. They'd agree, but they'd be lying. Each would scheme to claim my immortal soul by extracting it through my corporal being. Of course, I'd never give in. It would be a lifelong fight between two pointy succubi for dominion over my spirit. So both Tanya and Sister Stevens were always inviting me to their respective churches to check out a service. The churches were of a type found all over the country. You know, the kind some dude or dudette decides they're a religious leader, and so they rent out a storefront or a hotel conference room, and they ask their friends to invite their friends, and if they're really good at it, they wind up like Joel Osteen or Rick Warren, rich and famous and allegedly holy. In shitty neighborhoods, they're usually in storefronts, but this was Beverly Hills adjacent, so their services were in fancy hotels. Since Tanya was pointier, I decided to attend her cult gathering first, and hopefully sex would be a sacrament. So I was committed and ready to meet any challenge Tanya and her Church of Manolo Blahnik or whatever would throw my way. About a week before I'm scheduled to go, I see some big dude hanging around Tanya's desk. As I walk by, she grabs me and introduces me to her boyfriend. Well, that Sunday, I developed a sore throat and chills. Scratched Tanya's cult. So next stop was Sister Stevens. Her service was being held in a big ballroom in the famed Riot House. This was the Hyatt Hotel on Sunset Boulevard, where Led Zepp and the Stones and every groupie in L.A. would congregate for orgies and throw televisions out the window and ride Harleys up and down the hallways. So I'm figuring, yes, maybe this cult will have sex as a sacrament. I get there a little late, and I open the door to this ballroom, and inside are several hundred people sitting on folding chairs, and at the front of the room is some guy in a brocade vest with a blonde mullet and the energy level of that Tony Little TV workout guy. And the instant I set foot in the room, the guy screams, "Larry's here!" And I look behind myself because he can't possibly be talking to me, and the entire crowd gives me a standing ovation, and Sister Stevens and some other babage gently take me by my arms and guide me to my seat, way up front by the preacher man, and he proceeds to thank me profusely for joining the group today and partaking in their fellowship. The fellowship word was used repeatedly, and I want to tell him that I've no interest in the fellows, but Sister Stevens and some of her ladyships were just fine with me. And I sat there for most of an hour, listening to this guy hopscotch around scripture with a Bible in his left hand and his right hand waving around like Esa-Pekka Salonen. And I'm wondering if maybe several floors above me, Axel and Slash are getting an orgy going, and could I possibly crash it if I tip the desk clerk lavishly? And once it was over, the holy man with a mullet made a beeline for me because Sister Stevens had no doubt told him I was not parking cars at her office, and he sensed some concrete financial upside in bringing me into the fold. Had he folded me between Sister Stevens and her girlfriends, he might have had a deal. How many kids wind up in cults because they are seduced into it by attractive chicks and guys? Most of them, I guess. As it turned out, I never really connected with Sister Stevens. I put $20 in Mullet Man's donation jar and thanked him for the fellowship and left. I thought it was worth it just for the rockstar reception I got when I arrived. Where the hell could you buy that for $20? I left the ballroom. But before getting in my car, I decided to prowl around the hotel for a while. I stopped at a few different floors looking for what? For Harley's skid marks on the carpeting. I hoped to hear a genuine rock orgy in progress and slip inside claiming to be an A&R man for some recording label. I passed a room and heard Led Zepp's Cashmere, but the volume wouldn't have been enough to piss off anyone. I made my way to the rooftop pool, the same pool where Robert Plant and Keith Richards and rock royalty for decades had indulged in sordid debauchery. How could I have missed that train? Why did I have to be a fucking suit? I leaned on the railing and looked down on the streets of West Hollywood. A wind hit my back from the Pacific. Below was the Strip, the Whiskey, the Roxy, and the Rainbow, inarguably the incubators of rock and roll. To the north were the Hollywood Hills, including Laurel Canyon, where everyone from Alice Cooper to the Eagles, the Doors, and Frank Zappa had rubbed elbows and more. Years later, I would find myself in Zappa's old mansion, the one with a big tree growing right through the ceiling in the living room, watching a XXX movie being shot. But that's a story for another show. I hopped an elevator and returned to my car. As I wheeled out of the Riot House, I looked in my rearview mirror. Behind me was 3,000 miles of America and all of my past. I was headed west, as I had been for most of my life, but at some point, land ends, and you just have to pitch your tent or start swimming. I figured I'd stay a while because even the kooks and brocade vests were more my style than New York suits with arterial plaque. Here, there was always open sky. I could breathe. I wasn't buried in canyons of concrete and glass. And as long as I could put gas in the tank, I could go wherever the hell I wanted, not limited to some mass transit hamster wheel. I never dreamed I'd stay as long as I have. But there's just something about this place. My pal Dick Masterson calls it the City of Failure, and he is more than a little bit right. But compared to other places I've been, it's the city of adventure, with all its warts and flaws. Hey, thanks for hanging with me again at the dojo. It's always great to be with you. Remember, we're starting Life Hacks from the Dojo, so send your demons to thatlarryshow@gmail.com. We'll help you kick their asses. And get over to my page at thatlarryshow.com and have a look at whatever the hell is in that tortilla bag that made my kid puke. If you like what you've heard, stop at iTunes and throw the show 5 stars. It really helps us get the take no shit mantra out there. And why not be a part of the inner circle of the inner sanctum? Join the Take No Shit Dojo at patreon.com/thatlarryshow. Special rewards and bonus episodes await you therein. And so, my friends, should you be approached by some pointy chick with an invitation to experience some fellowship at her bastion of spiritual replenishment, say yes. Take a few bucks in your jeans, but leave your wallet and credit cards in the car. I'll see you next Tuesday, right here at the crossroads of madness and enlightenment. And until that time, take no shit.